supposed to be a sensationalist book, and I'm not trying to expose your father. If I'm exposing anyone, it's me, my 16-year-old self, my hang-ups and my misconceptions, and the wrong thought patterns I had. And I hope a new generation of girls can learn from them. I think you should publish it. There. The words are out. We've been dancing around this for weeks. I've been dealing with Mummy and the lawyers and Dan and my own terrible confusion. I've been trying first to have my voice heard, then trying to work out what I really think. It was only when I actually read the proof that I realized what Joss was doing, what she was saying, how she was trying to set out her story as a tale to help others. Mummy couldn't see beyond the mention of Daddy. Dan couldn't see beyond wanting to protect me. The lawyers couldn't see beyond doing their jobs. But I could see Lynn. Wise, kind, humorous, talented Lynn. Taking a negative situation and turning it into something inspiring. How can I silence Lynn? I know Mummy thinks I'm a traitor. She'll always believe that Joss is a liar, that the whole story is malicious fiction designed to upset our family and nothing more. When I asked her if she'd actually read Joss's words, she just started ranting at me. How can it be true? How can it be true? I wanted to retort, well, how can my imaginary friend be real? But I didn't. Joss bows her head. Thank you, she says quietly. And for a while, we're both silent. Do you remember going out on the Masterson's boat? I say at last. Of course. She looks up, her eyes shining. Oh, Sylvie, you were so sweet in your little life jacket. I so wanted to see a dolphin, I say with a laugh. I never did, though. I've always kept snatches of that day in my memory. Blue sky, glittering water, sitting on Lynn's lap, hearing her sing Kumbaya. Then it turned into an imaginary memory, and I clung to it all the harder. I invented conversations and games. I built up our secret friendship. I created a whole fantasy world of Lynn and me, a place where I could escape. The irony is, if my parents had never told me Lynn was imaginary, I probably would have forgotten all about her. I'd love to meet your children, says Joss, breaking the silence. Please bring them to visit. I will. Definitely. We sometimes get dolphins here, she adds, twinkling. I'll do my best. I ought to go. I get to my feet reluctantly. Devon's a long way from London, and I need to be back tonight. Come again soon. Bring the family. And good luck on Saturday, she adds. Thanks, I smile. I'm sorry I couldn't invite you. Seeing Joss on my own is one thing. Having her in the same room as Mummy would be a step too far. Mummy does know that I've been in touch with Joss, but it's firmly in the category of things she won't acknowledge. It's fine, Joss nods. I'll be thinking of you, though, she says, and draws me in for a tight hug, and I feel like, out of all of this, something good came. A new friendship. Or a new, old one. A real one. And then, in a blink, it's Saturday, and I'm getting ready. Makeup done, dress on, hair sprayed. There's nothing else I can do with it. Even flowers or a jeweled comb would look ridiculous. My hair is even shorter than it was when I first hacked it off. I went to the hairdresser and, after gaping in shock, my regular stylist, Neil, pointed out how jagged it was and how he'd need to really go in there to even it up. He calls it my Twiggy look, which is sweet of him because I don't look anything like Twiggy. On the other hand, it does suit my face. That's the general view. Everyone who blenched when they first saw it is now saying, you know, I actually prefer it this way, apart from Mummy, of course. I've tried to talk to Mummy a lot over the last 6 months. Many times I've sat on that sofa of hers and tried to bring up different subjects. I tried to explain why I cut my hair off and why I can't be treated like a child anymore, shut out while the grown-ups confer. I've tried to explain how wrong the whole Lynn thing was. I've tried to explain how mixed up my feelings are about Daddy. I've tried over and over to have a proper, empathetic conversation, the kind I feel we should be having. But everything bounces off. Nothing lands. She won't meet my eyes, or acknowledge the past, or shift position an inch. For her, Daddy is still the golden, untouchable hero of our family. Joss is the villain, and I'm the turncoat. She's locked in a kind of ossified reality, surrounded by her photos of Daddy and the wedding DVD, which she still plays when the girls visit. I won't watch it anymore. I'm done with it. Maybe I'll revisit it in 10 years' time or so. So, the last time I went round for brunch, just me, we didn't even talk about any of it. We talked about where Mummy might go on holiday with Lorna, and she made Bellinis, and I bought a set of stacking rings, so versatile, at the special one-off price of £39.99. Normal price for all 5 items, £120.95. And at the end she said, "Darling, this has been so lovely." And I think she really meant it. She likes the bubble. She's happy there. She's not interested in bursting it. "Mummy!" Tessa comes running into my room, dressed in her chosen outfit. Chelsea top, tutu skirt, and glittery trainers. There was just a nanosecond when I considered laying down the law and forcing her into the adorable, dusty pink, wild and gorgeous dress I'd seen online. But then I stopped myself. I'm not going to force my girls into dresses, or hairstyles, or thoughts that aren't theirs. Let everyone be who they want to be. Let Tessa wear her Chelsea top and Anna her Gruffalo costume. They'll make perfect bridesmaids. Or whatever they are. "Daddy says, see you there," she announces. "Okay," I beam at her. "Thanks." We haven't done the whole spend the night apart thing. I mean, this is a renewal of vows, not a wedding. But we decided to arrive at the venue separately. Keep some magic, at least. And Dan hasn't seen my dress either, so he doesn't know that I've splashed out on the most elegant, strapless, pale grey Vera Wang concoction. Well, it wasn't me who splashed out. Mummy offered to buy me a big-ticket dress for the occasion, and I agreed, without hesitation. It's Daddy's money that's paid for it. I reckoned he owed us. Dan and I had a bit of a money conversation a few weeks after I cut my hair off. I admitted I'd thought for a long time that he was prickly about my father's wealth, and he shrugged, looking uncomfortable. "Maybe," he said. "It's fair to say I was prickly about a lot of things regarding your father." Then he confessed that he does have a bit of a hang-up about providing for the family, and I said, "Like your dad," and he didn't contradict me. So then I tried to prove that we could, in fact, live on my income, if we made a lot of changes. So the old stereotypes were dead. And if he was a real feminist, he wouldn't feel the need to be the breadwinner, but could support the family unit in other ways. And Dan listened politely and agreed with everything, and then said, "Actually, we've got a big new order coming in, so is it okay if I carry on contributing financially? Just for the moment?" Thank God. I spray myself with Maze Lily of the Valley perfume, a gift from Joss, then step into my shoes and head downstairs to find the girls peering at Dora. "I want her to talk," says Tessa, who has just seen Harry Potter for the first time. "Dora, talk," she addresses the snake bossily. "Talk!"
"Talking snakes are not in real life," says Anna, glancing at me for confirmation. "Made-up things are not in real life, are they, Mummy?"
"No," I say. "They're not." I'm never going to tell them that my made-up friend came to life. They don't need that kind of complicated, weird stuff in their heads. When they meet Joss, she'll be Joss. "See you, Dora," I say, shepherding the girls out of the kitchen. I won't say I've got fond of Dora, exactly, but I can look at her.
I can kind of appreciate that she's an amazing creature, especially as I know she's moving out of the kitchen. Yes, result. Basically, our whole garden is being revamped. The Wendy houses have already gone, and the girls barely noticed. Instead, we're having a new outdoor room for Dan, all glass and wood, in which he'll have his office and a special space for Dora. And we're starting a vegetable patch. If you're such a bloody gardening expert, I said to Dan one night, why aren't we eating homegrown rocket every day? And he laughed and phoned up his mate Pete, who does landscaping, and together they drew up a whole garden design. They even planned to put in some hardy annuals. Whereupon Dan suddenly remembered me trying to interest him in the garden before and apologized for having been so distracted. He didn't need to. I get it. He had a few other things on his mind. Then we invited Mary Holland round to have lunch and help plan the herb garden, partly to show her and each other that there are no hard feelings or misunderstandings left. It was great, because John looked over the fence from next door and started joining in the discussion. So then he came over too, and we ended up with this rather high-powered gardening forum, all to discuss a tiny herb bed. Since then, Mary's been back to visit us a few times. She gets on well with Tilda too. I can see why you were worried, Tilda breathed in my ear about 5 seconds after meeting her. Meanwhile, Dan has taken to popping over to see John and talking about his work, while quietly making sure the fridge is full. And I do feel as though our existence has opened up a bit. We're doing a bit less watching our past life on DVDs, a bit more building our own present life. The girls can even have their own bedrooms now that Dan won't need the study. Except, of course, they don't want their own bedrooms, and wept when we mentioned it. And Tessa wailed, "But I will miss Anna!" clinging to her as though we'd suggested Anna go and sleep in the gulag. The car is waiting in the road, and as I shut the front door, I have a flashback to our wedding. Daddy leading me out of the house, me looking like a Disney princess. Like so many things, it seems a lifetime ago. A different me. Today, there's no one to lead the girls and me out of the house. There's no one to give me away. I'm not a thing to be handed over. I'm a person, and I want to commit to another person. And that's the end of it. Quite nice to be in a posh car, though. As we glide along, the girls wave at passers-by, and I redo my lip gloss several times and run over what I'm going to say. Then, before I feel quite ready, we're pulling up in front of Willoughby House. And even though I know this isn't my actual wedding, and I'm not a bride, and it's really not a big deal, I still feel a whoosh of sudden nerves. The driver opens the door, and I emerge as elegantly as I can, and passers-by stop to point and take pictures, especially when Anna gets out in her Gruffalo costume, holding her bouquet. We've all got winter bouquets of eucalyptus wound with ivy, which Mary dropped round this morning, together with a buttonhole for Dan, all from the St. Philip's garden. She gave me a massive hug and said, I'm so, so pleased for you. And I could tell she genuinely meant it. Come on, girls, I say when we're all in place. Let's do it. And I push open the door to Willoughby House. It looks phenomenal. There are flowers and greenery everywhere, cascading down the banisters and arranged in sprays. Guests are seated on gold chairs in rows, in the hall and through into the drawing room. Music begins and I process slowly between the chairs, up what is almost an aisle. I can see lots of volunteers, watching with misty smiles, all wearing pastel hats. Dan's parents are dressed up smartly, and I beam at Sue. I had lunch with her a couple of weeks ago, and apparently she and Neville have taken ballroom dancing up again. She seemed quite excited about it. Certainly they look a lot more relaxed today than they have for ages. There's Mary, looking gorgeous in a pale aquamarine dress, Tilda in a jeweled shawl, Toby and Michi, Mummy in a new pink suit, talking animatedly to Michi, probably selling her stacking rings. My heart catches as I see John, with his distinctive white, tufty hair, sitting on his own at the end of a row.
He came, even though Owen's really not well these days. He still came. Clarissa is standing to one side, capturing everything on video, and Robert is at the other side, recording from that angle. He meets my eye and nods as I pass. He's a good guy, Robert. And there, ahead of me, standing on a small, carpeted platform, is Dan. He's dressed in an elegant blue suit, which brings out his eyes. His hair is glowing in the sunshine, filtered through the famous golden-stained glass window. And as he stands there proudly, watching the girls and me approach, he suddenly reminds me of a lion, a victorious lion, happy and noble, head of his pride. At least, joint head with me, obviously. I think that's understood. The inspiration to use Willoughby House as a wedding venue came originally from me. Dan and I had decided to renew our vows, and I was Googling places, and they all promised elegant rooms and reception space, steeped in history. And I thought, hang on, hang on, hang on. Talk about monetizing Willoughby House. It's made for weddings. It took a bit of time for the license to come through, but since then, we've already had 3 weddings, all daughters of supporters, and there are more inquiries every day. It's changed the whole nature of the house. We have constant influxes of flowers and visiting brides and all the hope and excitement that weddings bring. It's fun. It makes it feel like a proper living space again. Not just that, the website is up and running. A proper functioning website, where you can book tickets and read about events and everything. The online shop will come, and it makes me feel joyful every time I log on because it's not like every other website. It's us. We couldn't afford 3D spinning pictures or celebrity audio tours, but what we've got is beautiful line drawings on every page. There are drawings of the house and artifacts and even a sketch of Mrs. Kendrick on the history of the family page. Every page is more charming than the last, and it feels like the perfect alchemy of old and new. Just like Willoughby House. Indeed, just like Mrs. Kendrick, who has recently discovered texting, and now sends Clarissa and me emojis pretty much on the hour. Welcome, everybody. Mrs. Kendrick steps forward, and I stifle a giggle because she's gone and bought a robe. A kind of high school graduation robe in deep purple with trailing arms and a square neck. I mean, really, it quite suits her. When it came to the question of who would be the officiant at our renewal, it occurred to us that this isn't a legal ceremony, so anyone could do it. And actually, I couldn't think of anyone I would rather have than Mrs. Kendrick. She was very touched. Then she asked me about 100 questions a day about it until I wished I'd asked anyone else. But now she's standing, beaming around as though she owns the place, which of course she does, saying, "Today we are delighted to welcome Dan and Sylvie to this historic house to renew their marriage vows, which is an honourable estate not to be undertaken lightly," she adds, making dramatic gestures with her capacious robe sleeves. "Those whom God hath joined together, let no man put asunder." Okay, what? This all sounds very random, but she seems to be having a good time, swirling her robe sleeves, so what does it matter? "Now," she continues, "Sylvie and Dan have written their own vows, so I will pass you over to them." She steps to one side and I turn to face Dan. My Dan. He's haloed in the golden light. His eyes are all crinkly and loving. And I thought I was on top of this. No problem. But suddenly I can't speak. As though sensing this, Dan draws breath. And I can tell he's choked up too. Why the hell did we decide to make emotional vows to each other in front of other people? Why did we think this was a good idea? "Sylvie," he says, his voice a little crackly, "before I make my vows, I want to tell you one thing." He leans forward and whispers in my ear, "We're going to St. Lucia tomorrow. It's all fixed up. All 4 of us. Family moon. Surprise." "What?"
What? I thought we were done with surprises. He was not supposed to do that, although, oh my God. Sir Lucia! I blink a couple of times, then lean forward and whisper in his ear, I'm not wearing any knickers. Surprise! Ha! His expression. Dan seems temporarily to have forgotten about making his vows, so I'm about to launch in with my own set when there's a slight kerfuffle from the entrance hall. The next moment, Dr. Bamford is making his way into the room. He waves at us cheerily and takes his place on a chair. Surprise, I say to Dan. I thought he ought to be here. He started this all off after all. Good call, Dan nods, his eyes softening. Good call. And then somehow we've said all our vows and not cried or tripped up, and everyone has applauded, and we're all on the champagne. Clarissa is playing jazz records on the old gramophone, and some of the volunteers are dancing in a makeshift dancing space. I can see Robert talking intensely to Mary. There's an idea. And Dan's parents doing a rather flashy quick step. Neville's eyes are fixed on Sue's, and the sight of them moving in perfect time with each other makes me blink. Then, as if she can sense me watching, Sue meets my eye and smiles over Neville's shoulder, and I wave back. I catch Clarissa's eye as she changes a record on the gramophone and give her a fond smile. Clarissa has been another revelation. 3 months ago, she stunned us by revealing she'd written a ghost story set in Willoughby House and recorded it as a podcast. Without telling anyone. She said she'd heard me suggesting it, and it had stuck in her mind, and she thought she'd have a bash. It's up on the website now, and keeps being downloaded, and we all know that Clarissa will end up going into writing full-time one day. She just doesn't seem to know it herself yet. As I'm standing there with Dan, watching everyone, he leans over and murmurs, Have you told Mrs. Kendrick yet? Or Clarissa? I know what he means and shake my head. Not the time, I say quietly. After we get back. I'm so proud of everything we've achieved at Willoughby House, and I love the place more than ever now it has a new lease of life. But nothing changes if nothing changes. I saw that slogan on a T-shirt the other day, and it really resonated. I've changed. My horizons have shifted. And if I want to keep on growing and changing, I need to challenge myself. It's taken a while to work out what to do next, but I've finally found the perfect thing. I'm masterminding the campaign for the new children's wing at the new London hospital. I saw the advert for the post and instantly thought, yes. It's a big job, and I had to persuade Cedric and his board that my skills would transfer from the world of art history. But every time I think about it, I feel a surge of adrenaline. I'll be helping children. I'll be achieving a whole new level of fundraising. And someone else can take on my work here. Someone with fresh eyes and energy. Sometimes you need to poke things with a stick. If I hadn't poked our marriage with a stick, what would have happened long term? I don't like thinking this much, because it's irrelevant now that everything did come out and we're okay. But let's just say, I don't think it would have been great. When I look back at ourselves, I feel that the Dan and Sylvie who were married for all those years, who were so pleased with each other, who thought life was such a breeze, they're different people. They had no idea. Congratulations! A booming voice greets us and I see Dr. Bamford approaching, glass in hand. How nice to see you again, and thank you for the invitation. I've always meant to visit this place, but never have. Wonderful collection of books. And the basement kitchen. Fascinating. You probably think it's strange that we invited you today. I smile up at him. But as I think I said in my letter, you really started something when we saw you all those months ago. Oh dear, exclaims Dr. Bamford, and I can tell he doesn't remember at all. No, it was good, Dan reassures him. In the end. In the end, I nod. You told us we would have another 68 years of marriage and it kind of kick-started. Well, we didn't react brilliantly. We freaked out, says Dan, honestly. I mean, 68 years, that's a lot of box sets. He laughs at his own joke, but Dr. Bamford doesn't seem to hear. He's peering thoughtfully at Dan. He transfers his gaze to me, then back to Dan.
68 years, he says at last. Dear me. I may possibly have overestimated a tad. I tend to do that. My colleague, Alan Mackenzie, is forever chiding me on the matter.
Overestimated? What do you mean?
Overestimated, I say, staring at him.
What do you mean? Overestimated, Dan echoes only half a second behind me.
Dr. Mackenzie recently advised me to shave a good 0.5% off my calculations, which would mean you have closer to, let's say, 64 years.
He beams cheerfully, then notices a tray of canapés passing by.
Ah, smoked salmon. Excuse me a moment.
As Dr. Bamford pursues the canapés, Dan and I stare at each other, stricken.
I feel cheated. I had 68 years, and now I only have 64.
64 years, I gulp at last.
64? That's no time.
Dan looks equally traumatized. He seizes me to him as though we're counting every second, crushing me against him.
Okay, so we only have 64 years, he says. Let's make them count. No more wasting time, I agree, fervently. No more petty arguments. Live every moment.
Set the alarm earlier, says Dan urgently. 10 minutes a day, we can claw back some time that way.
He looks so worked up that something inside me says, wait a minute. We're overreacting again. Dan, I say more gently, no one actually knows. We could have 72 more years together, or two days. My gaze travels around the room, suddenly seeing everyone here in a different light. There's Mummy, with her brittle smile, who thought she would be with Daddy for a lot longer. John, facing a future without Owen, his eyes sad even as he talks to Tilda, who herself had to cope with a life that didn't pan out the way she'd hoped. Dan's parents, still dancing, faces determined, making it work. Mary and Robert, chatting closely with shy smiles, maybe at the start of something. And my girls, dancing joyously in their Chelsea top and Gruffalo costume. Out of all of us, they've got the right idea.
Come on!
I put a hand on his arm and squeeze it fondly.
Come on, Dan. Let's just get on with life.
And I lead him onto the dance floor, where everyone breaks off to applaud us. Dan throws some shapes and Tilda whoops and the girls spin round and round with me, laughing. And we get on with life. This is Fiona Hardingham. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Surprise Me by Sophie Kinsella. This program was directed by Christina Rooney. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2018 by Mad Hen Media Limited. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.